start?
Yeah.
Okay, you start.
Yeah. Yay. All right.
All right. You guys introduce yourself?
We've got a couple more people in. Yeah, pull up a chair. We'll widen the circle if we need to. This is the sanctuary. They're in the studio, yeah.
Which session are you wanting? Okay, you're in there.
I have three extra waters.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
Let me slide to you.
Apparently, I have money.
I'll take one.
It sounds okay. Water for me.
I'm sorry? Yeah, this is a website. RECNet.com/checklist. First of all, before we get into that, let's get into us.
Okay.
You want to start?
Sure. My name is Donna DiBianco. I started out in broadcasting in 1992. I went to school for broadcasting, and I started at a radio station, a college radio station, which was also a public access TV site. So we immediately were immersed in radio and TV all at once, and that was the way that the courses were set up. We also had to work in journalism. We also worked in-house printing as well as with the local newspaper. So we could gather a portfolio as well as 1 hour.
Somebody's
finishing. We had to write a dissertation on what we would do with the knowledge that we acquired over the years. I chose to go into originally, it was before community radio, but what was public radio. Take advantage of the shelf. There we go. Okay. It was public radio. So it was your NPR stations and all of that. So the training that we got was pretty much to a level of professionalism that slowly introduced what the history was. Has anybody heard of the Healthy Stations Project? Healthy Stations was introduced by the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. It was a way to amalgamate as well as, in my opinion only, was gentrify the public radio stations. Okay, so, you know, all jazz programming is done at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. All this type of programming is done, well, you know, music coming prepared for at 3 o'clock in the morning. No matter where you go throughout the nation, there is a standard in NPR broadcasting, which is still held today, that at 4 o'clock, no matter where you are in the world, at an NPR station at 4 o'clock, you can hear All Things Considered, or whatever that program went. Our station denied participating in that, and that's when we started introducing this community radio. Even though we were still students and it was part of our labs, we opened it up to the community. We had some very serious broadcasters that also were against that style of running a radio station. And so we opened it up also to the community. So we became what we call a hybrid station, full power, non-commercial educational station, hybrid. Okay? That led to the LRCA, right? And that opened it up to full-on community radio stations. Language changed. You didn't have to be part of an educational institution. College, as standards were set, be a 501c3, nonprofit, with an educational bent or purpose inside. That's when I crossed over to community radio. I rose in the ranks there, spent 9 years at that station. We won many accolades and all that great stuff. Transferred up to Olympia, Washington, to the coolest call letters in the world as far as I know, other than KSNM. It was Chaos, K-A-O-S. Very radical radio station. Very, they had already had the models of what a hybrid station was going to be. They had students participating, they had community members participating, for which I became the operations manager. I was hired on as an operations manager because of the experiences of failed FCC inspections. So the failed inspections at KSFR led to one of the coolest. I personally toot my own horn on this. We have failed on our log inspections. Our logs were a mess, and fortunately we had a very kind inspector. And that first inspection, I will be honest with you, I was a baby at that time. I literally hid in the newsroom, away from having to answer any of the questions, any of the participate in any way, shape, or form. I was terrified. The man was here in my backyard, and that was scary to me because I didn't know. I didn't even know. I was asked to participate in cleaning up all of the findable events that they had, and that's how I got into working exclusively understanding the FCC rules and regulations. The beautiful part is that I had trained a former FCC attorney to be a broadcaster, and then he showed me how to interpret and use the FCC rules and regulations to protect radio stations. So I worked on that team. We developed some policies and procedures that are all the way into the training of the front desk. What happened at the front desk at FCC inspections. And so, whether it's full power radio, like I said, most of my expertise is in full power radio because it's extremely detailed. The LPFM responsible, how many full power stations are here?
Okay, that's going to make things a little easier.
Yeah, it's going to make things a lot easier. We designed this to be the full power LP, depending on the majority. No, we're not throwing you out there. Come on now. You're going to keep me on track. You and Jim, keep me on track.
Well, I've had full power.
Yes.
Is it such a difference in the requirements?
Yes. There are a lot of similarities, but there are a lot of differences. The beauty of the LPFM requirements is that they are a little less detailed. They have given a lot more freedoms to the LPFMs in the responsibility. Okay. Now, the first thing that I want to cover is licensure. Okay. What does a license mean to you?
It means you're a radio station.
Well, what happens if you have, everybody have a driver's license, right? Everybody have a driver's license? So what happens if you get 77 DWIs with a license?
You lose it.
Okay. What happens if you get into too many accidents with your license? Okay. So what does a license really mean?
Permission to do licentious behavior.
It's a privilege, right. It's an absolute privilege, okay? And come with that privilege comes what?
Responsibility.
Absolutely. So each and every person that is participating, that steps foot into this building, is responsible for the first order of business is to protect the radio station license. That is your first job, period. And anybody, as an operations manager, and compliance officer, your responsibility is to protect the license. Everybody from the front desk to who's sitting in that fancy seat dropping F-bombs all day. Okay. If you're in the front desk and they're dropping F-bombs in the back, guess what? It's your responsibility to yank them, you know, or to at least file, report it to the appropriate manager. Okay. The second thing that road hazard responsibility is?
Maintain the signal.
Huh?
Maintain the signal.
Maintain the signal. Right. Okay, so the second responsibility is to maintain the signal. Why is it our responsibility to maintain the signal? So we can communicate, with our listeners. And as we communicate with our listeners, it is also our responsibility to ensure their health and safety. But this is what you can't say, just like screaming fire in a church or fire in a movie theater. We are obligated to ensure the health and safety of each and every listener that we reach. Okay? Sound very puritanical? It sure can be. Some people get really wigged out by that. But if you listen and critically listen elsewhere to other radio stations, you can see what your community standard is. Okay? Every community has its own standard. Okay. The FCC does take this into account. So when an inspection happens, it used to be very random. They don't have the staff anymore to do this, to come in and check in. That's what happened to us. It was a random hit. They were in for a conference somewhere and decided to go check our radio station, and we failed miserably. So generally what sparks an inspection now, we need to, we can get into that, is usually a complaint or a series of complaints. One complaint, to the FCC, they start getting 5, 6, 10, 12 complaints that are valid complaints, and that's something that we also need to understand, is that you are, and the FCC is still pretty good about, you're innocent until proven guilty, okay? The complainant that files this complaint has to have valid accusations, okay? We got popped at chaos. We had an inspector come down because somebody hijacked our signal. And fortunately, and I was on vacation, I had another chief, designated chief, to maintain a full power station. And I was at an FCB conference, and somebody hijacked the chaos signal. Now, the chief that was there got a recording of it, okay? And immediately called me and said, what do we do with this recording of it? And I said, you know what? We're going to file this. Because I worked with the inspectors up there very closely. I called my contact at the office and said, we've been hijacked. We have recordings of it. This is not our signal. And this is the time span, the estimated time span that it happened.
Your contact at FCC?
Yeah, I contacted the FCC right away.
How did somebody
they're not your enemy. They can be assholes, but they're not your enemy.
How does somebody hijack your signal?
Many ways to do it, but yeah, that's a whole other subject. So what we did is document. The biggest thing with the FCC that they want is a full running documentation of your operation. They want a full documentation of the operation. How does it work? If you follow the FCC LPFM inspection checklist, and you make this part of your regular weekly routine, monthly routine, semi-annually routine. I recommend for startup stations that they need to do it at least once a month to get into, again, we're developing these habits of running the station. So you do it once a month, and you go through this walkthrough. And this is what will take that fear out of the man in the suit coming in at your front desk and saying, I always walk into a radio station. Nice to meet public file. We're not obligated to have a public file. But that's a buzzword, I've had people say, are you from the FCC? You have a right to ask, are you from the FCC? They must show their badge if they are from the FCC. They must. It doesn't matter whether you're low power or full power. If they are from the FCC and you have a front desk person, your front desk is the gatekeeper. Your front desk should know almost as much as your general manager. Why? Because in the first 10 minutes of that inspection sets the tone for the way that inspector is going to handle your operation. Okay? Now, and this is from, you know, this is from any kind of, conversation engagement.
So the FCC is moving to stations not necessarily having an in-house manager?
Yeah.
So what happens then?
Yeah. This is where your training is very serious, each and every person. You're still held to the responsibility of everything in Part 47, you know, Section 73 of the CFR, Code of Federal Regulations. You're still, even though, and that's what happened with my rebellion on training and certification of DJs. Each DJ is still responsible to know those rules and regulations. And just because they're not giving you the licensure and you don't have to go to the federal building and do all the math and all that kind of stuff, we are still responsible for knowing all of those rules. And that's what, 1,800 pages?
It's quite.
1,600 pages or something like that. I never really counted the pages, but you're still, as broadcasters, each and every person is responsible for knowing those rules and regulations. And this is why Miji developed the OPFM checklist. I used to do the full power. I still do full powers. I go out to stations and walk them through an inspection. So, good? Okay. So, for LPFM, Misha, go ahead.
Right, well, the FCC has published, they have a publication called the Low Power FM Self-Inspection Checklist, and I don't use that because it's outdated. It has not been updated since 2007, and there have been some changes in the LPFM service since then. So what I did was, for a couple GRCs ago, I created this training, and there's also my version of a self-inspection checklist that you can download from there, which to me is in a much easier format than the one that the FCC uses. It's done in a way where it's, I think, two pages. Well, you know, and the thing is that what the self-inspection checklist does is it allows you to go through and look at the things, it points out the things that the FCC is going to look for if they didn't do an inspection.
How many inspections do you have to fail before you lose your license?
It depends.
One.
Not for a lot.
And it could be in 10 minutes, depending on the violation.
Yeah.
It depends on what they do. Losing your license, actually, is very difficult. In order for you to truly lose your license, you have to misrepresent yourself in the station to the FCC. In other words,
within 10.
Don't lie to the FCC. That's called lack of candor. And there's a whole process that they go through, which is a little bit out of scope of what we're talking about today. So what we're talking about today is basically in the trenches, the things that your station needs to look out for to make sure that your station is in compliance. But one of the things you might want to consider also is joining your state broadcasters association. Your State Broadcasters Association is not the NAB, and we have found that State Broadcasters Associations, unlike the NAB, who represents IHART and CBS and Cumulus, are more accommodating to LPFMs and other small stations. And they have a voluntary inspection program that usually comes with their membership, where you can call and say, hey, send somebody out from the State Broadcasters Association, and what they will do is they will do kind of like a mock inspection, like if they were the FCC coming, and they will look for the various things that we're going to be talking about here in the checklist training here. And then what they also actually do is, if there's issues, they'll tell you about them. But they will also, if you did pass an inspection, sometimes they will actually contact the FCC and let them know that they inspected you, it was good. So that way it kind of puts a nice little gold star in the eyes of the local field office.
And you do the opposite.
And if the opposite happens, generally you have 30 days to correct it, and that engineer and inspector will come back out. And again, through the documentation, which we have an issue at Chaos, through the documentation, the inspector, because I knew the rules for the full power radio station quite well, he was like, no, you're supposed to have this. And it was like, no, here's the code and section that says, no, we don't need to. And so we got into this little tete-a-tete, and sure enough, it's like, please research this, and I want my letter, my gold star, that, you know, Chaos passed it. And, you know, it turned out that I was correct. So the better you know the LPFM rules and this process, the less fearful you're going to be, the more knowledge that you have. And it is our responsibility as LPFMers to know twice as much as a regular broadcast station. And the reason is, again, it's the same image that has been cast upon us as LPFMs, that we're not serious, we're old, you know, old pirate stations, that all we want to do is subvert the paradigm. No, we want to change the paradigm. And the way we can change the paradigm is understanding the paradigm intimately enough to go past whatever muster they want to throw at you, so you can continue operating and doing what you're doing, which is changing that paradigm.
What is the main thing that people fail at?
Ooh, well, you've got, you know, operating out of safe ranges of frequencies, overmodulation. You've got, now this is on the inspection side of things, okay? This is not what somebody would call in or to complain to. Your documentation of the station. I've seen stations get in trouble for illegal signage or improper signage on your tower signage.
Tower lights.
Your tower guy.
And your towers, 200 feet.
Public files.
Painting used to be a big one. Your public file, which LPFM is not really responsible for a public file, but there are some things that have to be readily available for inspection, and we'll get into that. And so these are the coverages of the common.
So the bottom line is that LPFM stations are not required to do this self-inspection. It's just for your own CYA. Mm-hmm. And also, too, if you do one, you don't have to tell the FCC. You don't send anything to the FCC. It's for your own records. And I would strongly suggest that you keep your self-inspections for at least 2 years. If anything, keep it up to your renewal. Mm-hmm. Keep it up to your renewal just to play it safe, because you never know when something at renewal time is going to come back and haunt you. Well, let's go on to the station records.
And the beautiful part of this, the way this is set up, as I observed being on this side, is that these are, again, the highest finable offenses to the less finable offenses. So we're going to get into the biggies on this, and then the little stuff.
Yeah. Quick question, since the subject of towers came up, if you don't own your tower,
you're still responsible.
Still responsible.
Yeah, yeah. It is generally in the full power radio world. It is generally your chief operator's responsibility. So whoever the tech is for the LPFM or the geek for the LPFM, it's usually their responsibility, all the way down to, believe it or not, the DJs. The DJs, you know, and I at KSFR, again, it was one of those, I looked up on Alameda Hill, and how come the left light is out? You know, and it's like, whoop, we didn't know that. And, you know, we got to fix it. So, it is everybody who inhabits that tower space is responsible for maintaining that tower.
Guide wires, painting.
Guide wires, fencing, painting, signage, all of that.
Yeah, there's specific rules around that.
Yeah.
It's covered in a different part of the rules. So accessibility for inspection. Now, of course, all the FMs are not required to have to staff a main studio, and except for those that are, the few of those that are, that were in timeshare agreements or MX, that they have that pledge, that 20-hour pledge, which applies to maybe about 4 dozen stations. You know, there's and also too, even for those stations, there's no requirement to have a meaningful management presence during full, you know, during business hours like there is right now for full power main studio rules. Bottom line is that, you know, you must make your station available for inspection during the station business hours, or technically really any time it's in operation. And now you're wondering, okay, you probably are not around a lot, it's unattended operation a lot of times. So what you need to do is, if your station is operating unattended, this is one of the big ones that a lot of folks don't know, that if you're running unattended, you do need to notify the FCC. There's an informal process that you go through to do it, to inform the FCC that you are in an unattended operation, and to give the name and number of the contact person that the FCC can call if there is an issue. This is kind of like in lieu of the chief operator kind of a situation. And so, you know, and also part of operating, part of that is also monitoring of your meter readings, basically. Now, a lot of the modern transmitters, including, I think, everyone that you all should be running, because you all should be only running certified transmitters, that are specifically certified for LPFM, those transmitters should already have equipment, they should already have functionality in them that automatically shuts down the transmitter within 3 hours of a meter out of tolerance type of situation. I mean, if you're, you know, if the frequency drifts off too much, or the power goes up, or, you know, more than 105% of what you're supposed to be at, or something, you know, happens, it should automatically kick off.
What form is that to let them?
There's not a form. It's actually just a letter.
Okay.
It's just a standard letter, and they'll put that in your file on the CDBS, and that's part of your communication with the FCC, which is a pretty good file to have handy also for a public inspection, because you now have this working, living due
paper,
diligence.
Paper trail.
Right. It's a paper trail due diligence. This is the FCC legalese language that we can use to show that we are being responsible as broadcasters.
Can it be held against you to send in that letter years after you should have sent it in?
No, but it's better to do it sooner than later. And you know, somebody, an inspector
might
give you
a FCC understands that you've gone through a Don and REC training and that you now learned something that you didn't know originally.
Donna said, do this.
And, you know, exactly. It is mentioned even in the FCC publication. And, you know, honestly, the FCC recognizes the service was designed for people, for organizations that were never into broadcasting before and have no experience in broadcasting and now want to broadcast.
Right.
That's what this service was intended for. This is why the rules are so easy. This is why the reporting requirements are much fewer than a full power station, because they know you guys have other things to do.
Is this in the CBDS?
CBDS, yeah.
And you see it right in there in the mug.
Yeah, well, no. You send it to them.
Office of the Secretary.
File.
Send it to the Office of the Secretary. Just refer to your station, your facility ID. Say the station is operating an unattended operation.
Your FRM.
Here's your contact name and numbers, you know, for, you know, in the event that the station needs to be contacted while it's launching and while it's in. Otherwise, if you don't, so I'm trying to answer
the question.
What is unattended operation? So, like, if we're on automation between midnight and 6 a.m.?
If there's nobody there to read the meters once every 2 hours or so, you know, that's basically what it is. If there's nobody there to monitor the tolerances of the station. See, I remember when I volunteered at my very first station, that was one of the things we had to do. We were an attended operation, so every hour, we had to go into the transmitter, every 2 hours or so, we had to go into the transmitter room and read the meters. And if the power drifted off a little bit, you have a little switch where you can adjust it and put it right back where it is. And that was one of the responsibilities that we had.
Right.
Fortunately, that was back in the 1980s. Now we're in 2017. The equipment basically does a lot of that for you.
Right. But and don't rely on that equipment. That's the part. It's good to understand that that equipment is operating there for you. But I am still a proponent of paper log with blue ink. Okay? And there's a reason why blue ink only in the room. The only other color allowed on the log would be a red, which was, again, for full power stations, assigning an EAS test. That becomes a legal and binding document. Okay? Your log is a legal and binding document that can be used in your defense, and it can also be used against you. Again, now this is way advanced. You screwed up the inspection, you pissed off the inspector, and now they're coming after you. I want to see your logs, I want to see this, I want to see that.
Is it blue because the copies are made?
Right, right, exactly. And the blue would make it the official document. And then if you have to send it over and take a PDF picture of it, it's still in the blue ink that you could submit in your own defense or submit to your attorney if you have to get to that point in defending the license.
One area of your station needs to be designated as a control point, really. At that location is mainly like where the operation of the station is, because it's usually the studio.
It's the studio and the transmitter center. It's two control points. If you're in the main studio and your transmitter's on the roof, you need to have two copies of everything required.
What if you have 10 studios?
You have 10 studios, they each have to have a control point. That's
it.
Anybody who can control the signal. So if you're, broadcasting from this studio for 4 hours a day, right? And then there's a studio down the street that, is co-channeling with you. They have to have the exact same documentation
for every
studio. Absolutely. That's a control point. If you can cut in through your board to get onto the transmitter, that's a control point. Then that's what you got
to
do.
But pretty much what you need to have at this control point locations are the copies of the various logs that we're going to talk about.
Right.
As well as your authorization, your station license, it needs to be available there. What some people do is they'll take the station license frame and put it on the wall.
Yeah, and that is a requirement. It needs to be prominently placed at the control points. So what I usually recommend doing is that you keep the original license in the station file, okay, and you make copies of it, boom, copy, and then you can put those up. And that
is better if you put one at each control point.
Right, and
so
one
at each point. The logs be relevant to each control point, or do they have to
Yes, absolutely.
Just to each control point?
Each control point.
So you don't need the log from Studio B to get Studio A?
No. All the logs for any event, as soon as that studio takes over the signal, that's when they start logging. So the next studio would log their channels.
I mean, practically, that could be electronically done. You're just saying the blue ink log, paper log.
Yes,
the log is to be your best. They actually verify that.
Right.
And you're going to find that not to get them, you're going to do very few log entries.
Not if you go through my trainings.
Right, but I'm just telling what the saying what the absolute minimum is. Like Donna will cover things that you should put in your logs just to cover your own booty.
Well, and it's not only just covering your own booty. The way the logs that I designed for stations is it is an opportunity. It's not just we covered our ABCs and XYZs, okay? I could do, again, at a full power station, we're responsible for filing quarterly issues and programs. So there's an issue in the community. What did the radio station do to address the issue? Okay, we covered it at the public affairs show. This is where your public affairs people. I train the public affairs people to report in such a way that we can extrapolate that information in a very quick and easy way to use it to go to funders and grant makers and donors and foundations to help the radio station. So it's a multi-purpose law that you can use. For LPFMs, it's very effective for that. The issues and programs is not a responsibility of LPFM to do, but it's a good best practice to have because it makes it very easy for a decent development director to go in there and say, oh, here's, you know, the women's issues, well, why aren't we talking to the League of Women Voters to get money from them? KRBS in Boise, Idaho, $45,000 grant. Boom, cut a check right there. This is what you're doing for women? Boom, here we go. Take this money.
So does anyone, do you all have an example of what a law should look like?
I do. Unfortunately, we were not able to communicate with the computers, but I guess we're doing an email packet out, yes, at some point.
I also probably have copies with me here today.
Of my logs? Oh, okay.
Yeah, so okay.
Sure. Okay. So we'll make a note. Yes.
Okay. Up at your transmitter, is that just the log up there? Is that just what goes on the transmitter?
Yes, absolutely. All the way down to, and again, I had a training film from he was included in a video that I produced with Pacifica. And my lead engineer at Chaos does a whole tour of what to do up at the transmitter site and how to maintain a log up there. And the reason why his logs were so detailed is you could walk in to that shack and know exactly what was inspected, know exactly what was working properly, what wasn't working properly, what needed to be fixed, that kind of thing. And it was great. His logging was so great. Again, it's about training your replacements. Everybody should have the same general knowledge. So you could walk in and read his logs and say, oh, we repainted this, we did this, we did that.
Okay. Now for the LPFMs, a lot of you, if you have your transmitter site, it's usually either in your same building or sometimes you're at a tower site like American Tower or something like that. And a majority, a lot of you I know are going to remotely access into your transmitter. So you're not going to have somebody at the transmitter site who's right. going to be watching things. I mean, a lot of that is the way we do that. That's the way we do it in the full power world.
Well,
but
I recommend for LPFMs at least once a quarter, somebody actually.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
At least once every 3 months, mm-hmm. go up and physically look at everything. And log what you've seen.
But as far as the transmitter and the station log, the absolute minimum things that you need in there is just pretty much when you're turning the transmitter on and off. If you notice some kind of an out-of-compliance condition, note it. Make sure whoever notices it also signs. Every log entry should have the name or initials or some way of identifying who it was that made that entry. And then once you clear the problem, then you log it again, especially with your EAS equipment. If you have to pull your EAS equipment out, we're going to talk about EAS in a little bit, but if you pull out your EAS equipment and have to take it down for some reason, you must log that. You've got to have that in there. And then as soon as your EAS is back in service again, log it again.
And if your EAS system is projected to be down for more than 30 days, you need to notify the
FCC. Right, and that's going to be covered in here.
Should you, I know you're bored there, should you fix your logs now to try to make stuff correct so that when you walk in and go, oh, you guys are very honest.
Yeah.
And you can have it run in 3 months or something.
Yeah. You know, again, you are just acquiring this knowledge at this very moment, mm-hmm. and you be very transparent about that. We just learned how to do this. I have initiated this log. So says me. Boom. On this date. And they will go a little bit easier. They're going to be like, you were supposed to know this beforehand. You know, because some of these inspectors are not going to have a great day. You know what I mean? Even if you do the AVIP, the alternative, some of them are trained at the non-commercial and the commercial levels, full power. This is why the LPFM, again, you need to know these rules as well, if not better, than the inspector that's coming in, because you have a chance to educate them.
Only the inspector is allowed to see the logs?
No.
Could Joe Blow off the street say, I want to see
Blow.
The logs?
Joe Blow can look at them. It's a matter of public record, because you are responsible for what?
Public.
Public trust.
Now, you have to give it right away to Joe Blow, or do you have some time?
No, you have some time. You sit them at a desk. And you let them, your front desk person says...
I mean, could it be like, oh, I'll get you in 3 days or
no.
tomorrow?
Well, yeah, you can. There is a reasonable amount of time, at least with the full power stations, there's a reasonable amount of
reasonable
time.
If you run into one of those situations, call me.
Yeah, call one of us. Yeah, call one of us. Because
yeah.
you don't...
Just call me on that. And
yeah.
Okay, we're not going to get into the discussion of the actual political file here, because that was discussed in previous workshops, but... You know, your political file, no matter how big or small it is, that needs to be in your, that's one of your things that you have to retain.
But I just want to do a quick question about what constitutes a political file?
When a candidate asks for time, and then you also, well, the candidate has to have a written request, from what I found out, that you had to have a written request for the station, you have to submit to the station. Then states are supposed to say we can do it at blah 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 time.
Right.
So
it's a bona fide candidate.
If a bona fide candidate contacts you, then you have to have a political file.
Well, the other part for safety is if you decide to have a bona fide candidate, because there's equal time rules and certain things, if you have a bona fide candidate on the air and you cover the topic, There's three reasons why you want to put that in your political file. The first one is that if the opposing candidate wants to complain, you have documentation that you offered, you know, airtime to them as well.
So you must offer. So if you have your show hosts, they invite the candidate. They must invite the other candidate.
You make an offer to the other candidates. They don't have to be there exactly at the same time.
Right.
But it's the amount of time. This is one of the reasons why when you build a show clock, you have these segments in them. You know, so if you give candidate A 22 minutes, you need to give candidate R 22 minutes.
Yeah, if you all have any additional questions on political files, get with Donna or myself.
Right.
We need to move along here. You know, the other one, the EAS log, which we're going to kind of talk about in a little bit here. Your EAS logs have to be in your in this file. Also, too, if you're the owner of the antenna and you have and you're responsible for an antenna that does specifically have a lighting requirement or a painting requirement, any of your logs around that needs to be in your logs too. Is that you know. If lights go out, if you want to replace them and such, and if you paint the tower and such, that all needs to be in there. These items must be maintained for a minimum of 2 years. I recommend that you keep them up until your renewal is granted, because there might be things, you know, something may come back and haunt you at renewal. Your licenses are renewed on a cycle, and the cycles are every 8 years. So I think we're coming up on some, I think the renewal cycle is going to be starting in next year, and over the next couple of years after that, if different states are going to renew at different times. And so always keep your stuff up until the renewal, but at least keep them for 2 years.
And this is when they come out of the woodwork to try and shoot you down, is at renewal time. You get a disgruntled former general manager, you get a disgruntled volunteer, you get a disgruntled, you know, other broadcaster. We are infringing, in their minds, we are infringing on their revenue. And they will watch us like a hawk. And they will. At that time, because you have to publicly state that we are, you know, going into license renewal, and they have 30 days to file any kind of discrepancies or complaints against the station. And the at renewal time, that's when the FCC really pays attention to that correspondence. That's the biggest time that they pay attention to it. And if there's run strips and errors, they're going to question you at renewal time, and then you, if you have the documentation, you can defend your position and your role, whatever that accusation was. And they give you the right and the opportunity to do that. Again, believe it or not, the FCC still does innocent until proven guilty. And it is, you know, anybody who's complaining to the FCC, they have got to have a valid complaint too. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to call Caitlin. Caitlin, I'm telling on this radio station. You know, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work on this. Caitlin's response would be more of, well, when did the incident happen? Do you have documentation on it? Can you substantiate your claim? And if they can't substantiate the claim, we'll take it under advisement. Okay? That's always those beautiful words. We'll take it under advisement. Now, I call Caitlin as an inspector, and I have, you know, Ms. Redding, I have this air check tape of this, and this sounds like a commercial. That's a big one, is your NCSAs and your non-commercial sponsored announcements and public service announcements. Here's a sample. I have a copy of a transcript of the script of this. Please, I want to submit this against this radio station. Ms. Redding will go and say, oh, let's review this. Let's get the transcript of this. Oh, here's violation one. Here's violation two. Guess what? You're not responsible enough. Here's your DWI, right? We talked about the DWI. Here's your DWI. Oh, there's six DWIs on this. Maybe you should not have that license renewed, and they will deny you. You will also have broadcasters say, well, you know what? I'm sorry, Ms. Redding. You know, your station is an infringement on mine. You know, my money-making, you know, Magna Radio, okay? We're going to file a petition to deny your renewal, right? And, oh my gosh, you know, that somebody filing a petition to deny. No, if you have that documentation saying, this is how we're doing it, we're clean as a whistle, we know how to do this stuff, guess what? Ms. Redding's going to say, they're abiding by the rules. Sorry, folks, you know, yeah, we understand that they may be cutting into your budget, but we can't hold them accountable because they're abiding by the rules.
Very few stations actually get denied renewals. The last one I noticed that was denied renewal was a situation where the station was brought on the air, and then it went silent. And it stayed silent for about a year, came back on the air for like 3 days, went silent again, and almost during the whole entire 8-year license period, the station may have been on the air for about no more than like maybe 2 weeks of accumulated time. And in that case, yeah, the FCC did knock it out. Now, some of it here, just basically everything that we covered on this first part of the thing, this is on the website, so, I mean, this is just, you know, this is just a little self-check that we have on there. And also, too, on the website, too, there's a lot of references to the various, these are links to the various rules that are discussed on this page, and also, too, to various questions and answers that have come into RAC over the years and are sitting in the big collective called the RAC Knowledge Base, which is available at our website. Now we're going to go on to the broadcast days.
Very, very rare to renew a license.
They really, you know, the paperwork and the investigation and the horsepower that it takes, I mean, it's incredible what they have to do as investigators to do this. It takes a lot. It takes, you know, taxpayer dollars in the tens of 50 to hundreds of thousands of dollars to compile something against
this. But a lot of times, renewals, you know, the infractions that are found during the renewal period usually was in the forfeiture. But the FCC will usually say that the level of what happened does not constitute a revocation, but we will impose a fine or we will admonish you for doing this. So basically, we give you a little mark on your record, you know, a little red X, you know, instead of the gold star. So that's where we're at.
And then you can go into consent decrees and stuff like that. Again, at that point, you're dealing with having an attorney representing you, you know, and all of that.
That's where the Michael Richards and folks like that come in. And, you know, we can go from now on and then you go from there. Now we get into some of the good operating rules that you got, you know, the basic rules that you all need to be attending to every day. And hopefully we'll clear a few myths.
Yeah, what is a legal station ID?
We're going to talk about that.
Well, we've got to start finishing up, so.
Well, and that's the thing. That's why I want to get through this.
Right, right.
So, you know, so key thing is operating schedule. Make sure that you're on the air at least 36 hours a week, 5 hours a day. You know, spectrum is rare. It's scarce, so we want to make sure that everybody is properly using what has been given to them. Station identification, this is a huge one. And I give some examples of what is legal, what is not. Pretty much you have to give your call letters. And your call letters are a part of, the LPA is a part of those call letters. And there are a few things that you can put between your call letters and the city of license. That's the city that shows up on your license. You can add cities on the end of it, just like these examples here. And I believe you have a question. We have a question.
Somebody have a question?
No.
No.
Okay.
You have to have one legal per hour.
One legal per hour, between 5 minutes. I would like to do this.
Only one per hour.
Yeah, one per hour at the top, at the earliest convenience in a natural program break, okay? When we had at Chaos, Amy Goodman was giving her graduation speech, and we had somebody jump in and do an ID while she was in the middle of speaking. It's at a natural program break, okay? And I like to do what we call the 10-minute sweep. Between 5 minutes of or 5 minutes after.
Yeah, that's usually the best time to do it.
Right.
Non-commercial operation, we can go for a whole entire day on non-commercial operation.
Yeah.
You know, we'll have, you know, there's other forms, of course. If you have any doubts on any language that's in your underwriting, let one of us know. I'm really good at going through those and fine-tuning them. One of the interesting things, if you do any old-time radio on your station, you can run, you are allowed, as long as it's not the cigarettes, you can run the old-time radio commercials on an LPFM, as long as it's not cigarettes. No LSMFP here, my LS or MST, that's not going to happen.
So in all but basically what you're saying is like on your own power, you can run commercials like the Shapely is one good to have, right? You can ask your bun that on a radio station.
If it's within the historical work of the old time radio show. So if you're bringing back Fireside Theater and they have Shapely beer,
yes. Yeah, because Shapely beer is not paying you.
Right. Shapely beer is not paying you, and it's actually, you cannot destroy the historical piece because that was already copyrighted.
And as far as the cigarettes go, that is not an FCC regulation. That is a regulation of the Federal Trade Commission,
FTC.
So the FCC has no jurisdiction on that. That's part of the Stop Smoking Act of 1968 or whatever it was.
What if they're not even in service anymore?
It's still because it glorifies smoking, you know, fine tobacco. It's toasted or fine tobacco flavor. I mean, come on, I think some of us have watched Mad Men. We know all the cash lines. So, you know.
Telephone conversations, again, this is part of the script. When you answer a phone in the control room, hi, you're on the air. Right? This is the radio station, you're on the air. You need to make sure your DJs, if they're going to do phone-in shows, that they are also taking, the minute you open the phone line, that DJ, whoever's sitting in that fancy seat, is responsible for all content.
The biggest violation here is when your DJ makes a call to somebody else and then puts them on the air without getting their permission first. That's the one that gets the huge fines in the commercial world. And that's what you do not want to do. You just don't want to dial, make like the prank calls.
Right.
A lot of those prank calls that you used to hear on the morning shows, those are all staged.
They're all staged. And the way you do that, again, if somebody is doing, there's scripts that, you know, that I've crafted that make it very clear that the express, it's called the express permission on the air. Again, it also works for, you know, people want to read literature on the air. The best way to get the express permission is get the author to actually read it with you.
Well, it's not liable, but it's pre-recorded.
Pre-recorded is in flight.
Same thing, as long as you have to have their permission.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, just best thing to do is just, you know.
I've also heard that the recording of a telephone call is often a state jurisdiction.
Yes.
States have rules.
Yes.
Can you talk about
It varies from state to state.
There's 50 states, and each state has their own
set of rules around that.
And
so
some states
that is something, that's a good point.
Exactly.
That is something that you want to check what the taping of a broadcast responsibility. Go ahead, Michael.
And actually, the state problem is with cell phones.
Right.
That I have a 202 cell phone. I'm physically standing in Maryland, where I live, 202's District of Columbia. Maryland requires two-party consent. D.C. only requires one-party consent to record, and somebody can claim you have to prove that that person who has a Washington, D.C. cell phone number, which happens in metro areas, people often want the city that's the center of the region as their phone number. I think that might help you, and the problem with this is proof, and also how much the person that is the recipient has a problem. So the best policy, whether you think of the FCC or state law for recording, is to say hello, explain who you are, say, do you mind if we record this for broadcast and be done with it?
And there's a very casual conversation that you can have in your opening of whatever you're planning to discuss with these people, and it's a real simple script, and that gives you the express permission right there, and it's stamped.
I need to interrupt for just a minute. You need to take your last question, but before
we
all disperse, we checked on the parking regulations. They are enforced today. I have been told that you can park for free where the meters are, but I'd really like to recommend that people go use the state lot. It's free, it's being monitored, and we know for a fact there's no problem here.
Oh, good.
I can't guarantee the meters.
Where is that?
It's directly down. There's a dead end, and then there's an arrow that says to enter.
Down Grand Street?
Okay. Yeah, I will give you enough time to get back. So, excuse me, Doc, last question.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, that's good to know. Okay, so we need to wrap this up, unfortunately. If we want to continue this conversation, we can find a place to retreat to finish it out, but this space is going to need to be used. If not, again,
bottom line is I just want to make sure that this information is available on the internet right now.
Right.
You can go look it up. It's recnet.com/checklist. recnet.com/checklist. And if you go there, that's where all the information is. Where this whole entire training session is. And again, you can go there.
I
just want to say thank you so much to REC for this, because I have learned so much from that song.
Yes.
I am REC.
Here, here.
I'm Michelle Bradley with REC. Yes, I am.
And then if there's any other questions and Michi doesn't want to talk to you, you can always contact me, communityradiogoddess@yahoo.com. Mm-hmm. Is the easiest way to get a hold of me. Email. Or, on the
LP. So you got some videos, or?
Yes, I do.
Are they on a website, or do you share them?
I share them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I share them. Thank you.
Okay.